Daniel chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the other, came out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground, so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had 4 wings, like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening, and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims, and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the 1st horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being, and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white as wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and people of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the meaning of all this. So he told me, and gave me the interpretation of these things. The 4 great beasts are 4 kings that will rise from the earth, but the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the meaning of the 4th beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head and about the other horn that came up, before which 3 of them had fell, the horn that looked more imposing than the others and that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the holy people of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. He gave me this explanation. The 4th beast is a 4th kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue 3 kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and the laws. The holy people will be delivered into his hands for a time times and half a time. But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself.
Why is the world such a mess? Strife in the Crimea, violence and death in Rwanda and 101 other places, poverty everywhere, oppression in North Korea. Why? Why the constant international struggle and tension? The threats of war, rumours of war, wars. Where is God in all this? Well, I hope you're ready for some terrifying beasts and horns with eyes, because today we're going to find out. We're going to look through Daniel's eyes at a glimpse of ultimate reality. We're going to look through a chink in the curtain, as it were, into what the powers of the universe are doing, into where God is in all this. We've followed Daniel's progress over the last six chapters of this book, and we've seen how, as an exile in Babylon, Daniel's God-given talent led him to outshine all his contemporaries, to become chief interpreter of dreams and visions, which is very important in Babylon, and to become an able administrator, rising to become prime minister of the Babylonian Empire. Now he's much older, but he's throughout his life remained utterly faithful to God. He's seen a lot of life, a lot of crises, a lot of evil, attempts on his life, and attempts on the lives of his friends. But he's never seen anything like this vision before. It might help us understand it if we look at it like an impressionist painting. A picture's worth 1,000 words, isn't it? And this picture seeks to convey impressions, images that hit us at a visceral, intuitive, almost a subconscious level. We're meant to see and hear these dangerous beasts towering over us as they emerge from a wild sea. We're meant to smell their fetid breath, feel their power and violence and destructive force. With an impressionist painting, there's no point asking what that little fleck of yellow means. It's not supposed to be a leaf or part of someone's ear. Impressionist paintings don't work like that. That fleck of yellow paint is part of an overall picture to show the effect of light on water or whatever. We can't look at every single brushstroke and find a meaning for it. So with this vision, if we try and find a specific meaning for every horn or work out which earthly king it represents, we'll get nowhere and we'll completely miss the point. What we're after is the overall message. What on earth is it saying to Daniel and to us? Two more points before we get into the passage. Firstly, even Daniel, the supreme interpreter of dreams and visions, needs an interpreter to understand this one. And he's given one. So we can rely on the interpretation we're given. We're not just looking at an impressionist painting here. We've also got the painter himself standing right next to us, explaining it. But secondly, these impressionistic images retain a sense of mystery. In the end, to some degree, they're impenetrable, because they deal with realities that ultimately are just beyond our ken. We can go so far in our understanding, but no further. So what's Daniel's vision saying? We can split this passage into four bits, as per the headings on the back of the handout. We'll spend a bit more time on the first two, which cover the main vision and interpretation of it, and then look more briefly at the second two, which are concerned with one particular aspect of the vision, the fourth beast and its horns, and our conclusion. What hits us in the first 8 verses is that there's going to be trouble. The four winds of heaven are churning up the great sea. in Daniel's time, the sea was regarded as a treacherous place, and a sea churned up like this, chaotic waves driven in different directions by the wind, was an ominous sign of danger. If there was a soundtrack to this film, the music would now switch into a minor key, with tones of sinister foreboding. And sure enough, terrifying beasts emerge. They're bizarre. They're mutants. Indeed, the fourth beast seems to defy description. It's not like any animal Daniel knows. These beasts are abominations, and they're frightening. They dispense violence in an arbitrary, wanton fashion. They're programmed to kill and to trample underfoot. And then Daniel's told that these beasts and their horns actually represent kings and kingdoms of the earth. Kings, of course, for our purposes, includes presidents and prime ministers and dictators. And kingdoms nowadays includes empires and nations. But basically, we're talking here about human governments and authorities. Let's call them human powers. And we're actually quite used to thinking of human powers as beasts, aren't we? The British Empire was often represented by a lion, Russia by a bear, the United States by an eagle, China by a dragon. And notice, they're all quite threatening, they're beasts of prey. Max Hastings, in his recent book about the Second World War, talks about that titanic struggle between Germany and Russia, between Hitler and Stalin, as a battle between two monsters. Human powers, then, are beast-like. They appear dominant, sometimes threatening, sometimes downright murderous, as if they'll last forever. And they spell trouble. But, they have no autonomy. They've no real power of their own. We read in verse 4 that the first beast was lifted from the ground. The mind of a human was given to it. The second beast was told to eat his fill. The third beast was given authority to rule. Human powers, like these beasts, are lifted, given, told what to do. They can do nothing by themselves. They're also temporary. We shall see shortly that in due course, they're stripped of their authority, and ultimately they disintegrate or are destroyed. They're also generally opposed to God. The horn that spoke boastfully in verse 8, as Angela read to us so beautifully, is a metaphor for human pride challenging God. Human powers are often nasty. As that famous quip on the difficulty of running foreign relations has it, if we only dealt with nice nations, we wouldn't have many people to talk to. The result? Human powers are fundamentally opposed to God, and the result is corruption, injustice, exploitation, greed, turmoil, struggle between powers for dominance, and war. We need to be a bit careful here. Human powers are not all totally evil. Nebuchadnezzar ended up praising God. Cyrus, the Persian king, later allows the Jews to return to Jerusalem from exile. Last year, in that enormous tragedy of Hurricane Haiyan in the Philippines, one reporter said, "Tomorrow the Americans are coming." Americans meant water, food, help. America can be a force for good in the world. So can the UK. So can other nations. The point is not that human powers are all totally evil. It is rather that by nature, they are beast-like. The beast is in the heart of each of us. So any combination of human beings into an organisation is bound to be imperfect, including the church, including the city, city corporations and firms. Some will be worse than others. Some may be comparatively decent. But the horror of human evil and rebellion against God lurks. in societies, in corporations, in ideologies such as Nazism and atheistic communism. And especially, it lurks where power is concentrated in the state. We should expect trouble. Verses 9 to 17, the contrast could hardly be greater. Our chapter switches into poetry in verse 9, as the scene changes to God, the Ancient of Days, and his realm of peace, poetic beauty and holiness. He is anything but temporary. Ancient of Days implies eternal being. He's seated on the throne, always in control. The white hair symbolizes wisdom. The white clothing, perfection, righteousness, purity. He's a completely unstained character. And he's all powerful. He's worshipped by 10,000 times 10,000. That's code for innumerable. His power is not given to him. All power is his. He's the one who dispenses it. And then we see that the court was seated. So this is not just a glimpse of God, it's a courtroom. And judgment will be just. The books are opened, we're told. A record has been kept of what everybody has done. We're meant to be awed at this scene. But there's more. In verses 13 to 14 we read, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven." So we see straight away that this one like a son of man is of God. He comes with the clouds of heaven. Only God rides on the clouds of heaven. And he just rolls up to God. He approaches the Ancient of Days. No normal human being can do that. And he's given authority, glory, sovereign power, which is permanent. Everlasting, we're told three times in verse 14, just in case we missed it. Everlasting, not pass away, never be destroyed. This Son of Man is given authority, glory, and permanent power right before Daniel's eyes. Daniel is witnessing a coronation. The one being crowned is Jesus Christ. No wonder that Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man more than 90 times in the New Testament. Here in Daniel, well over 500 years before the birth of Jesus, in the midst of the low point of Old Testament history, the Jews exiled and almost given up in Babylon, we glimpse this coronation of Jesus, the Son of Man, who will come to rescue his people and who will come and judge the beasts. And we see one result of that judgment almost by the way in the middle of this scene in verse 11. The fourth beast is destroyed and the others stripped of their authority. Even the most terrifying beast cannot survive a second longer than God's judgment prescribes. So the conclusion here is pretty clear, isn't it? God wins. Evil may thrive in the present, but God is in control and will have the final victory. However mighty human powers may appear, however much they may trample innocent people down, fire them, persecute them, even kill them, those powers are temporary. God will judge them justly. So if you're not a Christian, be warned. Don't be deceived by the human powers of this world. Don't fall for their threats or their apparently glamorous rewards, whether it's power or position or wealth or gratification or fulfillment or whatever else they purport to offer. It's all phony and it's all temporary. This passage was written not in Hebrew, but in Aramaic, the common language of the Babylonian and Persian empires. It was meant for everyone, not just Jews. It's a warning to everybody. When Jesus returns to execute judgment, don't be found on the wrong side. But supposing you are a Christian, or you're considering it. Verse 18 says, the holy people will possess the kingdom forever. So that's all right then. Or is it? Because Daniel's not so sure. He's had that first interpretation of his vision, but he knows there's more. And we see that in verse 19. He's disturbed, and rightly so. And even while he's asking, he sees the horn in verse 21 waging war against the holy people and defeating them. There's still trouble ahead. In the end, the Ancient of Days pronounces judgment in favour of the holy people in verse 22. Yet, the interpretation that follows is ominous. The fourth beast, the one with the metal teeth and claws tailor-made for ripping flesh, and its descendants will in the meantime be allowed to wreak havoc, trampling, crushing, devouring, and it seems that the holy people are the intended meal. A new evil king will challenge God, seek to usurp him, oppress his people. The holy people, God's people, the saints, will be delivered into his hands in verse 25. It will seem as if evil has won. Here is a warning for Daniel. Even when the Jews return from exile, opposition will continue. The return to Jerusalem won't mark the start of the eternal kingdom. That's not going to be yet. Half a millennium later, Jesus confirms this warning for us. There will continue to be wars and rumours of wars. Daniel's vision does not tell us when all this will end, and neither did Jesus. But the end will come. The holy people may be delivered into evil hands, but we see that it's for a time, times, and half a time. In other words, it's for an unknown but very precise set length of time, not a second longer than the limit God has set. The court will sit, and in verse 27, for the third and final time, we're told, the kingdom will be handed over to the holy people. So there's going to be trouble, but God wins. There's going to be oppression, evil, wanton, random, arbitrary violence and death, rebellion against God, affecting all nations and particularly Christians, but God wins. It'll sometimes seem as if evil's dominant and is going to triumph, but God wins. God is in charge in the city and everywhere else. But how can we be certain? Where's the evidence that the eternal kingdom really has been given to the Son of Man? Jesus Christ. That it's not been given to the evil beasts and the Satan who inspires them. How can this vision be validated, as it were? The conclusive evidence is that Jesus Christ has already triumphed on the cross. On the cross, God, through his Son Jesus, defeated Satan. Satan, that inspirer of human rebellion and evil. The one behind the evil beasts. He may still be active, but he's limited by God's decree and God's boundaries, just as he's always been. In fact, in a sense, Satan is more limited now because he's already been defeated. He has lost his power. He may be allowed to continue his deceptions for a time yet. We don't know how long. But don't be deceived. He's dead meat. For Christians, who are the holy people, this is huge encouragement to us to remain faithful. In spite of appearances, however benign things might seem, we're warned that they can get nasty. But however nasty they get, and however despairing we may feel, God is in charge. The cosmic battle has been won, as of course it was bound to be, by the all-powerful God who loves us. If you're not a Christian, this passage is a warning to make sure you get onto the right side. If you are, it provides huge encouragement. There's going to be trouble, but be encouraged. God wins. Let's pray. Father, we praise and thank you that while there will be trouble, you have made Jesus Christ Lord over all, and his people will inherit your kingdom forever. Amen.